as I was writing, I couldn't help but, like, I don't know, engage that pessimism a little bit. I think the poem itself is more pessimistic about art's, I don't know, potential for social intervention than even I am.
Hi, this is Bianca Stone. Welcome to the Ruth Stonehouse podcast, where we talk with poets and philosophers and scientists and more about what's going on with their lives and in the world right now, always through the lens of poetry. Today, I'm so happy to be talking with the poet John James. John James was born in California and raised in Kentucky. He's the author of Thonic, winner of the 2014 Cunt Bank Chapbook Prize, and his poems appear in such magazines as the Boston Review, Kenyon Review, Gulf Coast, Poetry Northwest, and Best American Poetry 2017. He's also a visual artist, and his collages have been published in multiple journals. His most recent full-length book is The Milk Hours, published by Milkweed Editions, and I'm so happy to welcome John to the podcast.
Thank you, Bianca. It's good to be here.
Good to have you. And we're also joined today by Ruth Stonehouse Letterpress Director Candace Jensen, who is going to be helping move the conversation along since her and John have some incredible overlapping interests in their art and writing careers. You guys can talk more specifically about your interests in these areas and where they overlap, and it certainly coincides with some things we've been talking about on the podcast here at the Ruth Stonehouse in all different arenas, and something that we're just all faced with in the world today. But responding to the sort of philosophical and complex issues around ecological collapse, the natural world, and just our interaction with nature and ecology, and interacting with that in our writing and in our art. So I thought maybe you could start off, John, by talking a little bit about The Milk Hours and maybe some of the themes in that book around those issues and how that came to be.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, you know, I think one of the hard things about writing a book, and especially a poetry book, is you write so many of these poems in isolation. And so I never set out to write poems that meant to be ecological or poems about grief or melancholy or, you know, or elegiac poems. They were all kind of things that emerged. But for whatever reason, I've always found myself interested in things like natural landscapes. The imagery throughout the book is often very, sometimes like guiltily a little floral, but I'm interested too in ecological cycles. And so if I'm drawing attention to flowers, I'm usually also drawing attention to things like roots and decay, which tend to be even more interesting to
me.
So I guess that's sort of, you know, where it begins, you know, in that book. Although, I don't know, I think there are other intersections we can talk about in terms of Candace. And some of our own thinking around ecology mm-hmm. and environmental thought.
Yeah, Candace, we were talking a little bit about it before the podcast, but how would you even define your interests and where they overlap? Or how would you talk about it? I called it eco-poetics. But I think that
eco-poetics,
like,
which is a word. Well, it's a big word, right? I mean, I've used that word, and John and I collaborated on a whole poetry reading, which was in conjunction with my art exhibition a year ago now, that we titled the Eco-Poetics Salon, and it was really exploring a lot. We touched on a lot through that event, and the way that poetry was sort of helping to actually make accessible some of the really heady stuff that gets buried in art. And I don't think that that's just my art. I think it's all artists. We have these wonderful abilities to somehow consume and then transform and alchemize just a wide array of information and experiences, and then it's somehow much more digestible, even though it's complex. So, I mean, in particular, there was that event that we did where John read, and, you know, we also had a couple of other really wonderful poets, Lynn Hsu and Timothy Donnelly. But, you know, it's interesting to hear you, John, say that you don't set out to write those poems that are about those things, that you're not seeking that. But it sounds like it also finds you, even though that's not what you plan.
Yeah, I mean, I think inevitably, these are things that I think about on a day-to-day basis. So, of course, they trickle into my poems. And they're the kinds of things that my scholarship often focuses on as well. It's kind of funny, though. I mean, particularly in relation to, you know, my, like, academic work. Sometimes the poems are, like, two steps ahead of where my research is about to go. And so I'll find kind of, like, themes or ideas bubbling up in the poems that I didn't necessarily anticipate, but were probably at work at, you know, on some level, even if it's a kind of like subconscious or just less than conscious level, they're sort of like at work in the back of my mind anyways. And so when they bubble up in the poems, then I can kind of, I start seeing them, start recognizing them, and then they become things that I can take on in a more straightforward fashion when I sit down to write an essay, right? Or I sit down to do research, and, you know, then I'm being much more deliberate. But the thing I love about the poems is the way in which they're not yet determined, right? Like there's something kind of open. There's an open inquiry that scholarship seeks to solve, and that I think for the poems, they're merely seeking to ask questions, right? And they can kind of rest with simply asking a question, you know, and being okay with that, of kind of cracking open possibilities and leaving them open.
Right.
Yeah, there's much more that, opportunity for ambiguity.
Yeah, absolutely.
And that reminds me of, John, a discussion that you and I were having a couple of months ago, which may have inspired the podcast. Bianca and I could not find evidence. but we were discussing about, like, whether poetry and artwork and the creative act of making, you know, anything really can inspire meaningful activism, or can actually create an impetus or a catalyst moment. And I don't know if we agreed or disagreed, but I love what you just said about the poetry being an open inquiry that can then lead to something much more deliberate, because that is definitely the way that I hook into the concept of poetry or visual art being useful in a sense, especially in terms of ecological collapse or, you know, industrial exploitation.
Yeah, I think use is a really interesting question there. And I think, I will say, I remember where it came from, which was a post I made, you know, that was, and you probably caught me at a moment, at a more pessimistic moment, but, you know, a post that was sort of just a little down on art's capacity to be able to solve, or to solve is probably too strong of a word, to even be able to really, you know, significantly intervene in large scale social crises. And I've been thinking about social disruption and stillness, right? Large scale social stillness in my poems, kind of even before the pandemic happened. Which then opened up like a whole nother like layer of, you know, things to deal with poetically and, you know, practically. But yeah, I don't know. I think part of my thinking in terms of that question, and part of the reason that I was feeling a little bit pessimistic about it, and I felt this way a lot, not just in relation to ecological questions, but I was thinking about this especially around the George Floyd protests last year. Many of which were happening in Louisville, and so I was, you know, I was really just a couple of blocks from where some of the Breonna Taylor ones, but they, you know, they more or less coincided. It was like very close to it, and yet I was, you know, trying to think about like art's capacity to be able to have anything to do with that, and it just felt so inefficacious. you know? And I wanted art to like be able to do something. And I saw so many people, you know, making social media posts, and yet I myself felt like I wasn't really doing much to actually intervene in like a direct or concrete way in that problem. But that problem, I think, extends to some of the ecological questions, or really any kind of like large scale social problem or social issue. So I think I definitely don't disagree that art has the potential to change people's minds, and maybe it becomes a kind of the pen is mightier than the sword kind of argument. I mean, I think art making and other forms of rhetoric as well can certainly inspire, although it can take a long time, the kind of large scale systemic change that ultimately we need if we're going to solve something like the climate crisis. But I think it's merely that spark, right? It can change minds, it can shape the way people think about things, and potentially even shape ideology, but it doesn't have the kind of direct or immediate impact. And I think that's what I was feeling so so down on.
I think this is really kind of fascinating to, because also it's like, what's the thinking about what the job is of art is like almost like thinking in a certain way that maybe isn't the only way. Like maybe art isn't, you know, there isn't just action to be taken to make changes, but there's also like art is in a way, it's like, it's sort of our way of processing absurdity in culture, and the whole reason, you know, how would we even get to this place, and like, why are we here, and how do we deal with our guilt and emotions, our ineffable emotions about our places in society, and our lack of connection with one another, and what it even means to be in a culture like this. And I think art, you know, it's like you don't even always know the question you can ask. So it's like, it's interesting to sort of think of it in a way that it's like, it's almost like unfair to ask that of art, because it's not the only way. I don't even want to say, I mean, I guess it's not the only way to make a difference and like thrive and like grow as a culture, when you're not actually taking physical action to like tangibly change something that in a way that the system itself has set the rules before you to do. You know, it's almost, I'm, it's hard to even articulate it, because it's almost like the rules are different for each, social justice and making art, but they also overlap in certain areas. So it's like that they're not mutually exclusive at all, but, they're like two different, they're two different realities or something. There are two different possibilities of human action. Is that even like making any sense? God, Bianca. Okay.
No, it makes a ton of sense to me. And I think that's a great question. Does art have a job? And I think we're putting a lot of pressure on art to even say that it has a job. I mean, it's nice if you can make any kind of money, you know, out of the art that you do.
But so many of us, does art have a union job is the question.
Yeah, but it's like, isn't it kind of like the problem that we're like, well, art, what are you giving to us? You know, like, what are you going to give back to the, you know, society? It's like, well, God, maybe we even the question itself is like a bit of the problem. Like, it's hard in the situations. Like, I think, John, so many of us were feeling the same way during that. Poets, or it just felt like I don't even want to post like this link to my poem, because it just feels like it's not, and I think poetry, that kind of stuff did have to take a backseat, and that was important. But now I feel such energy coming from poets responding, you know, to that, whatever was happening, you know, these things that we did have to take a backseat on before. I interrupted you, so I'm going to stop talking now.
No, I think you're totally right. Like I was saying, I think it's a lot of pressure to ask that of art, to ask, does art even have a job, but to ask art to directly intervene in any kind of, you know, large scale or systemic social problem. But yeah, I mean, I totally hear you. I think a lot of people felt very paralyzed and didn't feel comfortable celebrating or sharing that work. I mean, for people who, you know, had books coming out around that time, I mean, you know, I feel especially bad for those folks because, I mean, it's one thing to be able to share your work online. And I think some people, you know, now are finding finding audiences through doing Zoom readings and stuff like that. But I think at that moment, it was like, not only was there the pandemic and people couldn't get together, but people felt guilty about even like sharing their work, right, or celebrating something they'd created. I think you're right that like art did have to take a kind of backseat for a little while. And I don't know, I'm finding ways to respond to certain things, although maybe not everything, or everything that I wanted to respond to even then. Maybe it will come in time, and maybe art just is the place for it. And I think that's also okay.
Oh, yeah. I think that when Bianca was sort of waxing rhapsodic about the usefulness of art, and then this way that we sort of are locating art in its function or in its usefulness is interesting. Because I don't think when we're talking about inspiring social change, becoming aware of systemic problems, or pointing toward a new way of culture, really envisioning and becoming itself, we are not talking about utilitarianism, right? Because, like, no, art is never going to be a hammer. It's never going to be a Molotov cocktail, or maybe it could be. It could be a hammer or a Molotov cocktail. The expanded field of sculpture tells me both are true. But that kind of crux of like, yeah, well, we shouldn't ask art to be useful. We should ask it what the questions are we should even be asking. I think that's that point, is that it gives us a little bit of space to consider things so big that they're impossible to articulate a meaningful response to. And actually, I listened to a really interesting talk the other day by Andri Snær Magnusson, who's an Icelandic writer and intellectual. I had never heard of him, but he wrote this wonderful book on time and water, which I get the gist is about grief over the loss of the ice. And he was asking himself the same question. So I took the note because I knew we were going to talk today. And he was like, what is the role of, and this is a paraphrase because he was speaking quickly and with a beautiful Icelandic accent. But, you know, what is the role of artists? Are we just entertainers or do we have a real role? I love that question. And then he responded to his own question, like, we write stories, we tell stories, and it's really not so difficult at the end of the day. It's basically just putting something beautiful in the ground in an intimate and urgent way. And I was like, oh, yeah. I just loved the way that that settled in me.
Mm. Yeah, that intimate urgency is beautiful. And, you know, I mean, I think there's some truth to that. One thing I was thinking earlier, as Bianca was discussing, right, that question about, like, does art have a job? I mean, one of the things that I think art can do, and I think maybe this is like, really evident to all of us, but it can really personalize the kind of large-scale systemic problems that we all deal with in ways that can make those things much more apparent and make the complexities of those things much more apparent to people outside of ourselves. The great thing about writing, the great thing about art is it's an object that maybe begins in one place but can continue to exist in the absence of your person. And so because of that capacity, it has a way of communicating, right? That I think, I don't know, other forms of creativity or other forms of thinking and even communication don't necessarily have, right? They can't communicate the same kind of complexity outside of the immediate being, you know, of your own person, or your physical presence.
Yeah, and that does create a lot of intimacy with the reader. And I think that it really does come down to about your personal experience with the world and your unique perceptions and interactions with it, and trying to find a common ground with another person in order to realize the truth together, and from there sort of becoming together better people. And it just doesn't get any more beautiful than that. I think that to say that that's not helpful is just denial, you know. I mean, obviously we're all just sort of trying to figure it out and like learn how to be together and live on this earth, and we have so long to go, and I hope that we're able to take it farther, you know. I would love it if you would read us a poem, John.
Yeah,
so I think maybe what I'll do is read a first section of this longer poem that kind of inspired my pessimism, and I think that inspired the post that Candace was originally responding to. So this poem is called The Delusion of Being Absolute, and I won't commit the crime of inflicting a very long poem on listeners. It's not a kind thing to do, but I'll read just the first section. The Delusion of Being Absolute. Slicing the bellies of cold cod, I watched tankers plow into the bay's mouth, bridges taut cables glinting in shore light, the thrust of my locution anchored in addiction to place. I scrawled clipped missives, tucked the envelopes in a sack damp with the accretion of fog. I pined for the web's noetic buzz. In the pit I lit a fire, waited while the flame stripped the dry twigs. Sound bled from the sky's fissured maw. I thought of glaciers calving themselves, noise reverberating over a plain of packed snow. Witness was I to its deletion, its mass relaxing like a cube of ice softening in a tumbler's throat. In those hours, time distended, flies gathered, then dispersed, the water over mottled rocks repeatedly sloshing, each iteration of its movement modeling an attempt to set the record straight. The weather reports will not absolve us. Hills let the wind in. For a moment, the ocean's surface seemed a sheet of slate, the water itself technically expanding, worsening drought, potentiating flame. To me, there was only stasis, a locked to and fro by which the variability of the water's shape heaved a single pulse. The day spread. Tall elk chewed the stems peppering the cliff's ridge. Sun struck. Redness smeared the skin of my neck. I seared the fish flesh, listened to the pop of oil as it singed a thyme sprig. Evening cauterized the grasses, simulated fire with its crude light. My lips moved, and the drone of phonemes drowned the day's heat, a signage no less palatable for its investment in monotony. Once, in the supermarket, I combed the stocked shelves, searching the aisles for evidence of vacancy. I found among the varied cans of meat a cornucopia of choice, an emblem of abundance that formed its own dirt. Out of boredom, I listed the ingredients aloud. Their empty polysyllables rattled in my teeth. I'll leave it there.
This is gorgeous. I mean, you have such a beautiful vocabulary. I just get so much delight out of the words. The descriptions are so vivid. It's like I keep thinking, here is poetry that really designs a kind of landscape in my mind that I feel as if I'm walking through it, experiencing it so fully. What inspired this poem?
Yeah, that's an interesting question, actually. So I was in California at the time, and it was not 2018 when the really bad fires were happening, and there was a horrible fire in Paradise, California that killed upwards of 70 people. The year following that, the PG&E, so that's the Pacific Gas and Electric Company, shut off during really high winds in the fall, shut off power for large swaths of Northern California, including much of the Bay Area. and classes were canceled at UC Berkeley. So I was just sitting there, you know, my power actually wasn't out, but like a huge part of like, you know, North Berkeley and South Berkeley, like much of the city was without power. And so I was sitting there with like literally nothing to do. And it was like, for once there was a kind of stillness and I wasn't sure how long it was going to last. And I thought, let me just use this time that like I was lucky enough to kind of steal away and that I can dedicate toward a really like deliberate meditation on this crisis to think about it. And it's interesting that you called attention to the language, because on the one hand, there is that language of landscape and the really like concrete physical imagery. But I was trying to pair that with a kind of critical vocabulary. This sounded a little bit more like critical theory or something like that, in a way that, and I think this is what I've been trying to do in a couple of longer poems recently, is to draw lots of kind of disparate ideas together and sort of hold them in simultaneity. And I think that's at least what this poem attempts to do. But it's also at the same time, you know, meditating on the possibility of intervening in this situation or even just responding to this situation that I felt like I had, you know, really no control over, even though all I was doing was sitting there and making a poem. And I suppose that is a response, but I wasn't confident at the time. And I still don't know. I totally agree that we're asking too much of art to even like want it to have a use. But as I was writing it, I couldn't help but like, I don't know, engage that pessimism a little bit. I think the poem itself is more pessimistic about art's, I don't know, potential for social intervention than even I am. I was writing it like in the midst of that. This is just sort of what emerged.
Yeah, it's interesting that like we ourselves feel out of control and like and impotent, and our art is also out of control and impotent. So it's sort of like a solace in just sort of sitting with your art and being like, well, this is what we can do, you know, like, and I accept that. And there, that's why that grief comes through, you know, because, you know, so much of our human anxiety and sadness, I feel like, does come from this detached sense of like, I don't have any control over the natural world and I'm not even part of it. And it's sort of, we don't know what to do with that false information, or if it is false, or what it means. And it seems like, you know, I can really just picture you sitting there and the work, you know, just that stillness, like really working through that in poetry. You can sense your really deliberate, thoughtful mind at work. I mean, I get that sense in your book as well. You just are very good at slowing down and thinking. It's like, not a small thing.
I think also that's one of the reasons that John, in that poem, but in your work, you do get a sense of magnitude despite how precious and specific a lot of your language and objects or visions that we're sort of given treat to are. Does that make sense? Yeah, the magnitude really hit me in that poem.
Yeah, it felt apocalyptic.
I mean, part of it was that I actually, and yet there was part of me, I think, that was like trying to cultivate that sense too. You know, the event itself was not apocalyptic, but like was respondent to an event that like felt like it was. I mean, the year before, even though the fires weren't like dangerously close to the Bay Area, the entire, you know, the bay was just covered.
The air was horrible. It was, everything was red and amber and the lungs burned. It was so much.
Yeah, it was crazy. And also, I mean, as someone who grew up,
I mean, how can you not
out
feel
east, like I grew up in Kentucky. Yeah, exactly. You know, I'd grown up in Kentucky, you know, I lived on the East Coast, but I had never like been exposed to forest fires like that either. So, I mean, this is more regular than, I think I even at the time realized. You know, if you live on the West Coast, you grew up dealing with forest fires, but to me it was like, it felt really apocalyptic. It felt just totally, totally crazy. And just prompted that poem for me.
Well, I'd love it if you read another one, if there's a hard right turn or something.
So maybe, I have a number of possibilities here. I think I'll read one of the poems that's coming out in Iterant, and the one that Candace is designing a broadside for. And this is like the one poem I've written that responds pretty directly to the pandemic. It seemed appropriate because it's thinking about a similar kind of stillness, although still a different one, you know, not exactly the same sort of thing. And is thinking, I think, less deliberately about crisis, although I'm sure some sense of crisis registered in the poem. So this poem is called Still Life. Let me take a drink of water first so I can actually read it.
Yeah.
Still Life. I'm impressed with your forgetfulness. You see the keys and miss my face. Fourth floor canaries over scraped linoleum whistle and, through a phone, eject their downy feathers over tablecloths and worn doilies. You're nursing your disease with the notion that the contours of our present might continue through the fall. Are we alone in our loneliness? Your question, not mine. You want to clear your mind. Turning down the radio, sipping beer from a can, you bathe in the nearness of indiscernible voices, the pleasure of their hum, in static's hurried absence, which is also a sound.
Oh, I love hearing you read that after sitting with the poem for the broadside for so long.
Thank you.
That's great. There's like such an echo, or there's a sense of an echo, I think, that the enormous quiet, or it's like a lack of something, or perhaps waiting for something big and maybe even scary to happen, is the sense that I am left with after that poem.
Yeah, that's so interesting. I was workshopping this poem in the fall, and the Cecil Giscombe, who was running the workshop, he told me to take out the canaries in it. He hated the canaries because he thought it sounded too much like, because he had that same sense, right? There was like some sense of impending doom or something in it. And he said, it's too much of like the canary in the coal mine, which I hope, you know, people don't like read the canaries and like necessarily take that away. I don't mean them as a direct symbol in that way, but there is a kind of sense of waiting for something, an enormous quiet, maybe not impending doom, but a sense of kind of like conflict that has yet to really erupt to the surface, you know, that's kind of bubbling beneath it. I think it also speaks to a kind of domestic tension that a lot of us are feeling, you know, being stuck at home with our partners all the time.
We know.
Yeah.
We know.
Yes, me too. I can't believe this psychological journey the world is on right now. It's like big group therapy.
It's like mega therapy. We're all just like,
yeah, but we're all locked in our boxes. I mean, it's weird. Right. There's so many different evolutions that we've gone through in this past year. It's like, I was just thinking, I turned on the TV last night and I was flipping through all the different apps and stuff. And I was like, God, I remember like, TV was such a solace for me like back in like September of last year, and like now it's like I just feel so differently about it. Like I don't even care. Like now, you know, everything's like everything changes so much, and like how I felt about my husband in the beginning, like we've just like gone through so much together since, you know, and stuck in this fucking house together, and my daughter and the house itself, and I, you know, it's like, and my friends, like I don't like, I mean, I guess shit happens in a year anyway, but I guess the point, fuck all that, but like listening to your poem, I was thinking it just really nails it, because there was a sort of there is a sort of bated breath right now, and that makes a loud noise, louder than I think any of us living have had to deal with before. And honestly, it's kind of amazing because we're all forced to acknowledge this screaming silence and reckon with so much. So the world needed it badly, and here we are.
Right, like when everything is running smoothly and going along in a way that either you want to use the word normal or just sort of the way things go, it's very easy to tune it out, to tune out the ominous quiet, to tune out the concerns, to not really think much about it. And then the stopping is an opportunity to reflect, but it's also an opportunity to read poems that actually help you reflect. Or write those poems, just to bring it back into our original reason for being here.
I think the poems and the books that we're going to be seeing come out in the next 5 years are going to be really good. I think we're going to have some really strong new era in poetry.
Yeah, I think so.
Before
think
we wrap different. Things,
it'll be weird in a good way.
Yeah, it'll be weird.
It'll be weird.
The delay. This is Avenue 5.
The delay.
What do you think? How can you? What's your advice to people who are struggling to write poetry right now? What are some of your methods of getting the engine going in your writing practice? Or what's like a sort of pep talk and like why they need to be writing right now?
Yeah, I think I have two pieces of advice and two pieces of conflicting advice. The first is my usual advice, which is two words, right? Ass and chair. You know, sit down and make yourself write every day and something will come. And like, usually that's true and it might be for some people. But I don't know, I tried really hard to do that. Like, it was like this time last year. It was like April and May of last year. I've got one particular friend who is really good at doing like the April, like poetry month, you know, like 30-30 kind of thing. And she'll just like knock out a poem and like good poems, like every day in April. And like last year in particular, I just couldn't write anything. And this was a combination of a couple of things. It was like the pandemic, but also like I had just written a book and kind of just got done. Like, you know, at that point had been physically traveling around even like promoting it. I was really tired of talking about myself, tired of talking about the book, tired of talking about poetry even. So part of it was just being a little burnt out, but I needed to wait and let the next thing emerge, right? Like I needed that kind of fallow period in order for these new poems that were not the old poems and that felt different from the old poems to, you know, to be able to do their work. But I think it required a kind of subconscious decay or something like that, like a decomposition process where the old stuff kind of crumbled away and some new lines of query bubbled up to the surface. So I think like the advice I would give, you know, if ass in chair doesn't work for you, is just wait, be patient, and probably it'll come.
Yeah. I love that, the fallow period, letting the fertility return to the soil, giving it a break, not expecting it to produce when it's already given you so much, and then. Yeah. Because there is that pause, there's an immense amount of life that can flourish again later. I mean, you said that right when we sat down, like the way that so much of your work sort of is about cycles. So the fact that that's your advice is also on point, very on brand, John.
Yeah. Well, I will say like, and I, this is also not necessarily deliberate, but maybe more so than I realize, like, I find tons of gardening metaphors in writing, and I often, when I'm talking to students about poems, you know, like if you're talking about like culling a line, right? It's just like, you know, culling out like sprouts, you know, or like you got to clear out the garden and make space for the things that you want to really thrive to thrive. And, you know, the fallow period is a similar kind of metaphor. Those kinds of things are just all over the place in the ways I think about writing, in the ways I think about craft.
That's so beautiful and perfect for the spring. And I want to say thank you so much, John, for joining us today for this conversation and for the poems that you've written and are writing.
Thank you guys for having me. It was a pleasure.
And thank you, Candace.
Thank you, John.